Good evening. On this beautiful night of May 12th, you're listening to another edition of Perpetual Motion Machine. I'm your host, Kai Brito, young intern, learning the art of radio from the masters of the PNM team. But for this week, the topic's a little less about the Petri dish and more about the pair of eyes on the other end of the microscope. From a freshman essay professing diversity does not mean inclusion, to the social media movement, #TheRealUW, diversity has taken center stage, sweeping all news headlines and conversation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Underneath the social interactions on the UW campus, there's a narrative that exists mostly due to the current demographics of the undergraduate students, made up of only a 15.6 minority population. So what does that mean for us? You're listening to a science show, investigating science news, topics, and features. Does diversity even affect the scientific field? Well, that's what we're going to talk about in PNM tonight. Every 2 years, the National Science Foundation publishes a statistical report on the demographics within STEM disciplines. For this next part, all information is coming from the 2015 NSF report. According to the report, the percent of STEM bachelor's degrees for underrepresented minorities, or URMs, has increased from 16% in 2000 to 18.9% in 2012. And that's good. Don't get me wrong. Any forward motion is an improvement we can celebrate. But this trend isn't exactly true across the board. We don't see that same trend in engineering, physical sciences, or math. In 2000, the percent of engineering degrees was at 12.6%, and stayed mostly flat at 12.9% in 2012. It's the same story for the physical sciences, 12.1% in 2000, and it stays mostly flat at 12.6% in 2012. For math, we actually see a percent decrease from 13.4% in 2000 to 11.6% in 2012. And URMs are only part of the target population that needs to have higher representation in STEM. Females are also left out of the picture when it comes to science and engineering degrees. Although women did actually receive a higher percent of degrees in the biosciences for 2012, it isn't quite the same for other fields. Among computer science, physics, and all fields of engineering, the percent of women receiving degrees is under 20%. And for female people of color, the numbers don't get any better. But now that we have the stats to back up these claims, you've got to wonder, what exactly is causing these large disparities within the STEM fields? Well, the best way to understand this issue is to hear it straight up from the people actually experiencing it. I talked to Rick Tini Salatit, a people scholar and fourth-year university student studying mathematics. But he wasn't always a math major. He came in with a different plan.
I was an engineer, mechanical engineer. That didn't quite work out. Just because, I didn't really like the environment too much. One of the classes I took was really cool. Like, my teacher in my EPD class was very supportive. So, like, when there's times when, you know, obviously, like, sometimes our work maybe not be the best quality, but we're still trying, right? It's all a process. And he recognizes that. So, you know, he tells us that, you know, even if, like, you didn't do the best on this part of the course, you know, there's still time to improve and all that stuff. So that kind of stuff made me really want to, you know, keep going. So that was nice. But then somehow my other courses, though, like my intro class, it was kind of... I didn't feel that connection.
Rick's troubling experiences began in his first year in one of his required introductory engineering courses. As part of the College of Engineering admission requirements, students must take an introductory engineering course. Typically, there are three standard courses offered throughout the year, with Introductory to Engineering Design 160 filling most of the seats. Often there are two sections of this course, taught by the same set of professors and packed with over 200 students. Rick was one of those 200-plus students.
In my intro class, it just seems somehow like it wasn't as big a connection. Somehow I feel like we just kind of got thrown out there to do things. They didn't really give us enough guidelines. I don't know. I felt kind of bare being in that class and just kind of doing what they asked us. So it made it kind of difficult for me.
The hands-off approach taken by some of the intro-level professors can create an unwelcoming learning environment, especially for students that might not have strong levels of academic independence. But it was not only the professors causing discord in the engineering classes. Issues can arise with other students in the course as well.
My first group was actually really cool. I mean, we didn't get the best grade, but, you know, we all tried to work. I guess my last group disheartened me. I mean, you know, I'm willing to admit that when it came to searching for the sources, like, I had issues, I had trouble. You know, I tried the best I could to find, like, some useful information. I did find some. Maybe, like, not as much as the other guys. But then again, I tried to make up for it by, you know, being a good facilitator for the group. Basically putting the poster together, organizing the information, going out of my way just to go print the stuff and just make sure it's all together. But somehow I felt like for them, that wasn't enough. Now, I admit it in like when I had my own evaluation, like I wasn't the best in technicalities, but I feel like I tried to offer in other areas.
Rick's group didn't give him the best grade, but they didn't fail him either.
So the way it works is that you evaluate everybody in your group, and you can't give everybody the same grade. I mean, no doubt I didn't give myself the highest grade or anything, but, you know, I gave everybody, like, good grades in my report. But I guess in their report, they put me a bit below. So it turned out that I didn't, like, fail my, you know, my group grade, but I got a bit lower than I expected. And I was thinking, like, man, like, you know, really? Like it's just, I did put a good amount of share, you know, like, and I feel like, you know, if I was part of that group too, maybe like one of my guys couldn't find the best information, but I would be like, you know, it's okay, you know, like if you're doing other stuff, then that's what this team is about, right? We all have our strengths and weaknesses, so we try to work around it, right? And that's what I was trying to do, but I feel like maybe they just couldn't recognize that.
And it was this experience that really led him to reconsider whether or not he wanted to continue the engineering track.
Well, I guess it's always kind of like a slight air of competitiveness, but in there it was like very subtle, but kind of like, I don't know, like everyone was really for themselves. Somehow I felt like that vibe kind of killed my motivation for being an engineer.
But this isn't just an isolated issue. This is just one example of a larger problem that exists today. A problem that we need to address. Lucky for the UW, there's a group that exists to do just that, and they're already working on the UW-Madison campus. Not only to ensure that these types of students graduate, but also move beyond the undergraduate level and onwards to PhD programs. I spoke with Dr. LaRuth McAfee, director of the McNair Scholars Program, to gain more insight into this organization.
It's a program that is funded to support students from traditionally underrepresented fields. In this case, it could either be people from racial or ethnic minority groups or students who are low income and first gen. So first in their family to go to college, first gen in that way. Yeah, and it's an opportunity for us to identify students who really show potential to be the next leaders and support them through mentored research while they're in college, and then also support them in applying to grad schools so that they can hopefully get into grad schools, ideally doctoral programs, mm-hmm. and go on to become the next generation, you know, again, of leaders either in academic settings or other types of lab or corporate settings.
But Dr. McAfee had much more to say on the why of the program rather than the what. That seemed to be far more important to her.
The McNair program, again, were funded by the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the funding that we receive is used on a variety of things. So the students do get stipends, mm-hmm. But we also cover travel if a student needs to go to a conference, or as you mentioned, if they're going to visit a prospective graduate program, you know, we can cover expenses for that. There are also some kind of national McNair conferences that our students will mm-hmm. attend. You know, some of them are focused specifically on preparing for grad school, so writing your personal statement, mm-hmm. you know, preparing for the GRE and, you know, making sure you do as well as possible on that. You know, when you're going to visit graduate programs, you know, helping students understand pre-visit preparation is necessary, because you don't just kind of show up not knowing, you know, who you're going to meet with and, you know, what research they do. I mean, it's important to have some preparation done beforehand. So we have a number of things like that. As you mentioned, once students get admitted to programs, we'll work with them on how do they choose the right program for what they want to do, you know, so that it will be a good fit and a good experience for them. Negotiating packages, I think in many cases, are pretty standardized. But yeah, in some cases, there is some room for negotiation, mm-hmm. you know, even after a student gets a package, so that they can end up at their top choice institution and also get, you know, a nice financial aid fellowship and kind of funding package, you know, in these fields is more typical. But I think we try to work with them on a number of academic types of things like that, but we also try to work with them on kind of more the mentality of being successful in grad school, you know, or as a student more generally. So looking at growth versus fixed mindsets, you know, and encouraging students to think about growth mindsets, helping them understand how if they experience microaggressions, you know, in the lab setting, since these are all students from some sort of underrepresented background, while it's not inevitable, it's not uncommon for them to experience that. You know, so helping them identify positive strategies to not have that, you know, stop them in their progress, but, you know, so that they can overcome and still continue to be successful students. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's both an academic support that we provide, but it's also that social, you know, cohort-based, we're all in this together, and, you know, when I learn something, I can share it with you so that it will allow you to also be successful in your, you know, endeavors.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of touched on this topic a little bit. You talked about, like, experiencing microaggressions. You talked about just not understanding the field of PhD study. So why else do these students specifically need to be a part of the program? You mentioned underrepresented minority students, first generation, and low income.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely something where we see that students from those types of backgrounds are much less represented, you know, in graduate education than we see them in undergrad education or, you know, kind of society or, you know, American society more generally. So it's definitely an area where we see that if we don't try to encourage students along, if we don't try to, you know, help them develop the skills that will allow them to be successful, we aren't really going to see the demographics change, you know, in the graduate population. And if we don't really see the demographics change in the graduate population, we aren't going to see the faculty demographics change. We aren't going to see, you know, the kind of research leaders around the country change. So it's definitely something where we really play a key role in trying to help identify these students who, you know, I don't want to necessarily say are diamonds in the rough, because I would say some of them really come with some great experiences. I mean, there are some, like Dirk, one of the seniors this year, he was doing research in high school, you know, so some of the students had opportunities. But, you know, once they get into this type of setting, maybe they aren't the ones that the faculty are necessarily encouraging in the same way that the faculty are encouraging other students who, you know, come from backgrounds that are more traditionally represented, you know, in these disciplines. So I think the McNair Scholars Program really plays a key role, again, in encouraging these students along, giving them tips that perhaps on their own they wouldn't have gotten from faculty. And again, it's not true for all, but for some, you know, it is something where we're really providing them with cultural capital, you know, to be successful in a way that, you know, they perhaps would not have had otherwise. Okay. So does that answer?
It does. Okay. It really does.
Great.
I was wondering, from some of the works that you've done, you know, like helping students like get into research labs, helping students like navigate the field of where, understanding where to apply for PhD programs and then like visit and all that stuff that you guys do, that you provide services. What are the results that have come from that? Like, do you have any like numbers or ideas or like general trends?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I can definitely mention to you that since 2003, we've had 171 students go through our McNair Scholars Program.
Okay.
We're funded annually to support about 28 students a year. And the graduate school here, which is the home for the McNair Scholars Program, also commits some additional funding for about three more students. So about 30, 31 students a year we support through the program. So again, and it's a two-year, typically a two-year commitment. So 2003 to 2015, we had 171 students who participated in the program. 114 of them enrolled in graduate studies somewhere. 41 of them actually stayed here at UW-Madison. You know, so it's not only that we're preparing students here who are going off somewhere else, and actually I should say 43, stayed here at UW-Madison. But yeah, I mean, a number of the students, you know, end up staying here because even as undergrads, they start doing research with a faculty member here and they really get engaged in a way that it makes sense to stay here. Now, in some fields, the disciplinary culture is that people leave and go somewhere else for grad school. You know, so in some cases, even if staying here kind of research-wise and academically seems like a great fit, they're still encouraged to go somewhere else. You know, so... So yeah, in some fields you just aren't going to see them stay, but okay. For 43 of them to stay here in graduate programs, that's, you know, a pretty impressive number of students that we've, you know, engaged who have wanted to, mm-hmm. to stick around here.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit more about specifically the science aspect mm-hmm. of what you guys do for PhD studies. So I know that approximately about 40% of your mm-hmm. cohort needs to be about STEM students from yep. underrepresented mm-hmm. Minority group. So I was just wondering, what do you think about the field of science? Like, what would happen, what is the issue here that exists with not having enough scientists in America that from that diverse cultural background? Like, what happens when we don't have that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there are a few different issues right now that are coming into play. And, mm-hmm. you know, just to back up, so I'm a chemical engineer by training, mm-hmm. Went to Michigan undergrad, so go blue, and went to MIT for grad school. but when I was in grad school, I actually got very involved in student leadership activities and started thinking about kind of non-traditional ways to use my my background. So I actually did my postdoc in engineering education, and I've been doing academic administration, you know, really ever since then. So this is definitely an area that, you know, I've been looking at really for the past 10 plus years now, and looking at how can we in academia, you know, try to change processes or you know, programs, I mean, whatever the case may be, so that we can, you know, enable all students to be as successful as they possibly can be. So, and actually this role that I'm in now is my first position in which I've not been focused on engineering or science and engineering types of students.
Oh, wow.
You know, so here I actually have to look campus-wide, even though my background really is more in STEM disciplines. But in any case, I mean, I think we have a few things going on right now that make diversifying, you know, the STEM workforce more important. One is that jobs in those fields are increasing at a rate much higher than jobs in any other type of field. Mm. You know, so we need people who have this type of background to fill the jobs that are going to really lead our economy, you know, in the future. Along with that, though, our economy has really been built on, you know, this like baby boomer generation that is nearing retirement age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those folks are leaving, you know, the field because they're retiring or, you know, dying as the case may be. Now, granted, in this economy, maybe they aren't quite retiring as young as they initially thought they would, you know, so maybe the jobs aren't opening quite as fast as people expected. But still, it's a major exodus that will happen, you know, to our STEM workforce in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years mm-hmm. that, you know, needs to be filled. You know, and so along with this, though, the demographics of the country are such that continuing to, you know, base our workforce on the white male or, you know, the Asian male is not going to allow us to replenish the workforce and really fill all the jobs that we expect to have, you know, in the next few years, really, you know, but for sure, like in the next 10 or 20 years, we're seeing a lot of jobs being created in these types of STEM disciplines. So if we don't really look at more, you know, how to engage people who are from non-traditional, you know, or underrepresented backgrounds, we're really going to have difficulty filling all the jobs we need to be, you know, we need to have filled. So, you know, in STEM disciplines, that's definitely what we consider to be underrepresented minority groups, so Blacks or African Americans, Hispanic or Latino, and Native American, you know, American Indian, so Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, groups like that. Those are groups we really need to engage better, you know, because they're a growing segment of our population, but they're vastly underrepresented in STEM disciplines, you know, and in the STEM workforce, women as well. Are, you know, very underrepresented in many STEM disciplines, not all. The biological sciences are actually much more diverse than, let's say, the physical sciences. But yeah, so I think that's definitely one big area. I think another big area, though, that we're seeing now is when we talk about grand challenges, you know, in our STEM, or really in our society more generally, it's not just about, you know, really being very technically sound and very academically sound. It's about being creative. You know, it's about identifying issues and identifying creative solutions, you know, to those problems. And one of the things that we definitely see is that some of the solutions are not just going to come from one segment of the population. You know, the solutions in many cases need to come from ideas that come about by people from different backgrounds, putting their heads together, putting their experiences together. And it's really important for us to also identify problems that will be useful for a number of different people to have solved. You know, so, I mean, the water crisis in Flint, right? Yeah. I mean, like, that's definitely a big issue. And there are all these concerns about, you know, is environmental racism, you know, part of this situation? Because people didn't necessarily look at that as a population that we needed to be concerned about. But if we have more people, you know, who are from Flint, you know, or cities like Flint, you know, maybe they'll say, okay, this is a really important problem that we can't just ignore because it's something that's impacting my family. You know, it's impacting people I know and care about. You know, so I think also, you know, when we look at why diversity is important, part of it is just that whole piece of who gets to identify problems and who gets to be part of solving the problems, you know, and you need to have some cultural competence. You know, you can't just say, okay, you know, this is how I'm going to solve the problem because technically this is how it should be solved. You know, you also have to say, okay, culturally, how will the people who need to use this take to that? You know, and so the solution in one situation may be different than the solution to a very similar problem in another situation because culturally the people that need to be supported are very different. Yeah, you know, and so I think there are certain things like that that definitely come up when we talk about diversity in STEM disciplines that, you know, we need to have this group of people who are coming from different perspectives. And when you look at research, diverse teams end up getting better solutions than homogeneous teams. Now, maybe it takes a little longer to get to that solution, but once they get to the solution, it's a you know, typically a much better solution. You know, so I think that's another thing that we just have to keep in mind, that maybe it doesn't make the process as smooth as, you know, some of us would like it to be, but it is going to lead us to a better solution, and a solution that will work for more people, you know, and not just the people who have always had the solutions work for them.
But there's another audience that the UW hasn't addressed yet. Children. I spoke to Dolly Leedon of the Adult Role Models in Science program, or ARMS, to find out the story there.
So the name of our program is Adult Role Models in Science, and that's exactly what it's about. It's about adults. So we do not have programs directly for children. We work with existing programs all over the city that work with children on a daily basis and help to build their capacity to lead science every day. So it's not about just a few kids, and it's not about just one-time experiences. It's about preparing teachers, youth leaders, scientists who might want to volunteer, parents, and really any community member who wants to work with children, giving them some tools and ideas to be role models for children and to work with them on a regular basis, develop a long-term mentoring relationship, and really transform children's views of their own capacity and what their future might hold.
So that was the mission of her program, but here's the why behind it, and also some of the success that she's had over the years.
So in my course, the course is very practical, and yes, we learn a bit about research on how children learn and that sort of thing, but it's very practical in terms of giving them concrete lessons, investigations that they can then conduct with the children that they work with. And we spend a lot of time in class practicing leading activities and critiquing each other in how we're leading the activities and how, what kinds of questions we're asking to not only do a fun activity, but to really get the kids thinking like scientists. And so I feel that my students really become experts in not really, I guess science education might not be the right word to use, but more youth development around science. It's really that engagement piece of getting the kids involved, interested, and as I mentioned before, using those practices of science. And then they are out there in the community starting in about the second or third week of class in September. They get started and start leading science and do that every week throughout the school year. And so they really do develop relationships with the children in those clubs, because we try to have it a program where the same children come for the whole year and can really build that relationship with our students. They also develop really strong relationships with the staff. And I can't stress the importance of the after-school staff enough, and the importance of the classroom teacher and their role in all this. They are an equal partner. We're not just coming in and leading science in isolation of what else is going on in that program or that classroom. It's really an integrated part of what that teacher and that after-school educator, what they're doing. And so we really try to build their skills and use their skills in youth engagement for my students to learn from them as well. And so it really is a two-way street where we're learning from each other. Maybe there's an after-school coordinator or leader who is really an expert at engaging kids and knowing what works for particularly the population of kids that might attend their center. But maybe they're really not very comfortable in their own science learning. And then there's a UW student that's maybe a biology major or physics major or what have you, but maybe they've only worked with kids as a babysitter or something and really don't have those youth engagement skills. So they really need to work together as a team and learn from each other to be able to build those relationships with the children. And it's important for the children to eventually see that staff person as an adult role model in science as well.
So we've had a couple of different voices tonight share what they're doing for STEM education at the university, but they aren't the only ones that have to be doing it. Hopefully we've convinced you that it's important to have diversity in science, and that we will develop more fair, more equal solutions that way. Thank you for joining us on Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm Kai, and I'm signing off